My name is Jill. I'm a recovered but not cured compulsive overeater. Thank you for giving me the privilege to come here and do this. I need to do this. Is everybody okay? Okay. All right. Let's everybody take a deep breath. I'm presuming I can't judge if you're all suffering from the disease I am. I know without a doubt that I'm a compulsive overeater. And I know without a doubt that I have food substances that once I begin eating them, I will not be able to stop. It will be beyond my human control. And I also know that I have the mental obsession that will convince me that I need to go back to it even after I've not had it for a long period of time. I am thoroughly convinced, and I love this banner, Miracle of Transformation. I have experienced transformation. I consider myself recovered but not cured. I have been given a complete daily reprieve of the desire to engage in my addiction. Yet, nothing in my life changed. I changed. And how did that happen? So I'm hoping I have an hour and 10 minutes to try and explain to you how that happened, what I was like before. Oh, look, I noticed people who held the microphone this way, it worked much better. It's a long time to hold a microphone that way. How did I get there? What was I like before? How did I find OA? And what affected that change, that miracle? Let me see if I can do it. So, what did I start? It started as early as I can remember, and some of you heard parts of this last night, but not my life details. It started as early as I could remember that I was different. Not only did I think I was different about food, I just felt different. I felt separate, I felt apart from, I felt lesser than. And as early as I can remember, I really resented other people and I hated them because they were over there and I was over here and you didn't like me and you didn't treat me the way I wanted to and life just wasn't what I wanted it to be. Now, which came first? That and the solution I found in food? I don't know, and it really doesn't matter. I know the two of them grew together. I was a chubby child, and in 2004, my top weight was 360 pounds. Here are the pictures. I'll send them. Look, can we start them in the back of the room?
Absolutely.
I hear some people in the back of the room yesterday never got to see it. So bring them to the back, and if you don't get to see them, please come see me anytime. And I should have announced that. Somebody came to me and said, you know, I have a kind of private question to ask you. Ask me anything, but beware, I probably will give you a little more information than you wanted. This reclusive person who couldn't speak and could never speak in front of a crowd and could never tell you what I honestly thought or felt now suffers from like this. I need to keep it in check a little. So this started as young as I can remember. I'm going to try and weave in how my story changed. My first few years in OA, I told this dramatic story, what my mom did to me, what my religion did to me, what God did to me, what my first abusive husband did to me. And then all of this fabulous step work, this intensive daily inventory that changed me and my way I look at it, changed my story. And I find that kind of amazing. So it may have been more dramatic the other way, but it's a lot more honest this way. I was born into a very intense religion. And that probably didn't help my feeling like a freak. This religion believed in keeping separate from the rest of the world. I was very different. We were inundated with religion. We were inundated with the concept of God. That this afternoon's workshop is really important in my recovery because I finally learned how to lose that childhood vision of God and create what worked for me in recovery. So I blamed my religion for making me a freak. I blamed my mother for limiting my food. She always had us on a diet. Food was regulated. We could only have a little bit, and all I could ever think of was getting more and more and more and more. And I'd go to my friend's house. I was the heaviest kid in the class. She was the skinniest kid in the class. She felt probably as much of an outsider as I did. But I'd go to her kitchen, and she'd open a drawer, and it was full of snack food. And she'd like close the door, nah, I don't want any. What? I couldn't even figure out a way to get some when she wasn't having any. I remember being tortured by these things. My mom would bring home a dozen donuts, and there's four girls, two adults, do the math. I wanted more than my share, and I was so pissed off that I couldn't have it. So I blamed my mom. I blamed my mom for my food addiction. I blamed my religion for my miserableness. Basically, it stemmed, what I learned from step work is it stems within me and the way I look at life and the way I can't accept, could not accept life on life's terms. So here I am. I become this reclusive, shy, chubby kid who learns to diet. And I got boy crazy as a teenager. So now I desperately wanted to get out of the control of my religion and my controlling family. Basically, I had a very stable family. I had a mother, I had a father, we had a secure home. They had strong values. But I had this desperate need to get away, and I could only date people within my religion. So I crazy dieted myself down. The first guy I met, I needed him to validate me. And that's basically all it was. I needed to say to the world, look, somebody loves me. I didn't care that he did these awful things. For years, I blamed him for being abusive and for my food addiction, when basically, I knew the relationship was bad. I learned this through my step four work, and it took several years of step four work. I laid my soul to him, my weakness to him. I let him prey on that, and I hid it from my family so I could get out of the house. So I dove into this abusive relationship. Now, I met him when I was 15. I married him the minute I turned 18. Not wise. I don't blame myself. The Big Book promises we can look at the past and not regret it, but not wish to shut the door on it. These were fiery stories. The first time I told them, I wept and I cried, and everybody said, oh, I hear your pain. They have lost their fire. Through step work, I now see them for exactly what they were. I don't blame myself. I don't blame him. That marriage ended very quickly. I could meet him on the street right now and feel completely safe and free of emotion. That's what the Big Book promises us, that we can meet the world and look them in the eye and hold our head up. So anyway, I'm very young and very needy, and I get married and I move out there, and he tells me every single day I'm fat and disgusting. And at that time I weighed 121 pounds. Right now, oh, I never did qualify. I'm so sorry. I was 121 pounds then. Right now I weigh 150, so that's how fat and disgusting I was. But I came into OA January 2008. I got abstinent January 2nd. My first meeting was January 4th. You'll hear that in the how I got here. I have 6 years and 5 months of abstinence. I lost my last 50 pounds while I was in the rooms. I had lost a whole lot of weight on my own through sheer craziness, and I was on my way back up. And I was desperate, and I was scared, and I crawled into these rooms. And I'm so grateful for that. So I lost my last 50 pounds very quickly, and I've maintained my weight since 2008, give or take a little bit. This is basically a 210-pound weight loss. That is a miracle. It is a miracle. And you know what? It's not my miracle. It's God's miracle. And look, I'm totally digressing, but that's okay. I'm going to talk God a lot, and I ask you to please have an open mind and an open heart, that my concept of God is so different, and you'll find that out in the workshop. It's not religion, it's not a deity, it's not a being with a gray beard. I just use the word God for higher power because it's easier. If I every time have to say a higher power as I understand him, I'll never get through this. So I just use the word God. Please be open to that. So Here I am, he's telling me every single day, you're fat and disgusting, and he, I'm guessing, suffers from heart disease, because boy, did he have a sweet tooth, and every other day, I had to bake a major dessert. Listen to me, had to. This is what happened. I'd bake a major dessert, he would eat in front of me and say, isn't it a shame you can't have this? And he would leave for work, and he'd measure it and count the items, and they better be there when he gets home, and I was not working. Now, listen to the drama in this that I could tell of this story in my early days. Oh, poor me, what this horrible man did to me. It was just my life. It set me up for a lot of food behaviors, though. I would sneak, you know, change off of his dresser, and I would ride my bike to the convenience store, and I would binge on food, and I would throw the trash in the woods and get home. And I also learned to be really rebellious, like, screw you, nobody's going to tell me I can't eat. And I found out I could take flour and eggs and sugar and make my own dessert, and he didn't count the ingredients. He didn't know how much flour, sugar, and butter was gone. So it really created some food habits that plagued me. My disease was very progressive. I managed to keep my weight reasonable while I was married to him, but we were only married a few years, and he ended it. And I'm very grateful to the universe that that happened, because I would never have ended it. It was devastating, but he ended it. It was the best thing he ever did for me. So now, here I am, devastated, I'm needy, I've never settled any of my, now I'm pissed at my mom, I'm pissed at my religion, I'm pissed at God. The other thing he did was he pulled me away from my religion, and which took a huge effort. I went kicking and screaming, but so now, really, I have nothing. And the one thing I had that validated me, somebody loved me and made me worthy, got rid of me. So what do? You eat. And I immediately found another man, because this is what I did. So I'm in my early 20s. My mother, who I blamed for being cold and for never hugging me and never telling me she loved me, even though she loved me intensely, died a terrible death of cancer. And right at the same time, my marriage ended, I met my current husband, and somebody smiled on me the day I met him. I'm going on 29 years of marriage to him next month. He stuck with me through all of my craziness and addiction. But what happened is, my marriage broke up, and within 2 months, I was dating my current husband. Craziness. It was all absolute craziness. And he said, forget about it. Eat, drink, be happy. He could eat enormous amounts of food and not gain weight. He is not a food addict, but he loves food. So I started eating and started eating, and I really gained weight fast. So then the craziness started. I had this food that I had to have, and I don't know why I had to have it. There's a million excuses. All I know is I had to have it. Yet I was gaining weight, and I was fulfilling all those prophecies that my ex-husband had said, as you know, you're just going to get fat. When you're old, you're going to be fat. And here I was getting fat. And I did everything I could to control it. I spent money on diet clubs. I went to diet centers. I tried every crazy diet that came along. You know the women's magazines? Lose 20 pounds in 10 weeks, and that's always next to a picture of cake. Why is that? Make these cookies and lose 20 pounds in so many weeks. And what I was doing is I was limiting, dieting, and limiting those substances that all I can explain is my substances, sugar, flour, excessive fats, and all three together, the minute I eat them, my body went, and that's all, and somehow that made life okay, but for about 2 seconds. And I love the way the big book says, you know, it was my solution until it turned like a boomerang and cut me to ribbons. Because all of my dieting, all of my best human efforts, and let me tell you, I'm a strong person. Shocking. People tell me at work, you know, Jill, you're kind of a strong personality. I'm like, me? Really? Yeah. I'm a strong person. I'm an intelligent person. I applied everything I knew to try and stop eating, yet the hand still went to the mouth. Okay, I'll start again in the morning. Okay, I'll start again on Monday. I'll make a New Year's resolution. I'll try eating only between 6 and midnight on Saturday nights, all I want. None of it. It got me to those pictures. At 360 pounds, I have to sit and I've almost forgotten what that felt like unless I sit and think about it. Trust me, it's there. I couldn't walk up a flight of stairs, let alone carry a laundry basket. I couldn't fit in most chairs. I would walk to somebody's home and frantically scan the chairs. Which one am I going to sit in? And they'd say, oh, have this little delicate cane rocker. Like, really? I sit in that? It's going to fall over. It's going to smash apart. The pain of that, sitting in a theater seat. First of all, it amazes me, people who don't mind encroaching on the other seat. I would sit like this the whole time to try not to encroach on the next person, and I'd come home with bruises, literally black and blue bruises from the handles of the seat. Those are not the worst indignities. The skin infections, the going, not wanting to go into a dressing room to buy clothes, wearing my mother-in-law's hand-me-downs because I couldn't go buy clothes. Not being able to go to the doctor because I wasn't getting on a scale. Not even be willing to go to the dentist because there was no dignity to me in laying in that chair. I don't know, I neglected myself. I wore underwear that was in tatters. I wore clothes that didn't fit. I got to the point where the women's dress plus size shop went to size 5. And I had to shop carefully among the size 5s, because 5X, because they didn't all fit me anymore. So what I had going for me, when I say nothing in my life changed, I had some good things in life that I totally didn't appreciate. I had a husband who stuck with me through all of my craziness. He was there, and I loved him, but I was so self-absorbed and self-consumed, I actually thought, this is what I thought, he was the most well-adjusted, non-anxious, together guy. And maybe I needed to think that because he loved me and that made me okay. In recovery, I found out, you know, he's just a person. And he has his issues and he has his anxieties and he has anxiety attacks. I probably went years, I didn't even know he was having anxiety attacks. I was so self-absorbed in myself. I had 2 children. I had the first child, gained a lot of weight, did a crazy diet center, which I told about last night, where I lost 50 pounds in 12 weeks, and then put 50 pounds back on in less than 12 weeks. I spent a lot of our family money on these things, money we didn't have. We were pretty poor. And then the only thing I really thought I had going for me was I was going to raise 2 perfect children, because obviously I was worthless. And we know how that goes. So I became the martyr mom. I was going to prove to the world I was worth something because I was going to raise 2 perfect children, and they were going to brush their teeth, and they were going to go to college, and they were going to make a decent life. And this is what I did. I ate, and I raised my kids. When my oldest son, I tell you this because when my oldest son started having mental health problems in high school, and suicide attempts, and psychiatric, we had to commit him to a psychiatric ward, I thought my life as I knew it was over. Everything that validated me, so you can tell here all along, I lived my life in some sort of fantasy world about what real life was. I know I put my kids through hell because I was one of those moms that I was the martyr mom, but you need to do what I want you to do if you want me to love you. If you love me enough, you'll do what I want you to do. He started falling apart, and I thought it was my fault. So I had 2 choices. I thought I would either stop eating and die. I really, really thought I could stop eating and just die. Or I lasted 3 days. I'm a food addict. I've never been a restrictor. I've been a little crazy on the restricting side in my dieting at times, but I'm not an anorexic. I couldn't do it. So I thought, well, I'm going to prove to the world I'm a good person. And I can't prove it looking like this. So everything in my world depended on losing weight. Yet, I had to have this substance that my body told me I have to have, and my mind told me, you better pick it up again, because you're not going to get through the day. So it took me, that was 2004, I call that my bottom, when I decided I had to do this thing. And I took this picture, you can tell. This picture, we were on a school trip, I worked in a classroom, and we took a group of special needs students to Hershey Park, which is a park in Pennsylvania. I couldn't fit through the turnstile. In front of my coworkers, in front of the CEO of the company that owned this private school, they had to take me around to the handicap entrance because I couldn't fit through the turnstile. And then all this started happening with my son. And to me, it just made sense. Prove to the world you're okay, lose weight. So the craziness amped itself up. And I started low-carb diets, and I tried, and at first it was easy. At that weight, I could diet all week, binge on the weekend, get back on the wagon. Then I had to add in going to the gym and being crazy about that. And then I had to keep, and it got worse, and it got crazier, and it got worse, and it got crazier. And now I actually got from 360 pounds, I don't know how my family lived with me. Because I was living without the substance that I needed. The big book description of irritable, restless, and discontent, I must have been just a bulldozer. And I was still resentful, I was still pissed off. Nobody else behaved the way I wanted them to behave. God didn't give me what I wanted. I had so left God out of the equation. Yet, I could walk into beautiful, natural, and feel something. I knew there was something out there, but God, maybe the best description is agnostic. He certainly wasn't going to help me. It's just, you know, how I have to do it. So I got down to about 185 pounds, and the world said, you did it. You're a success. You have it together. Guess what I knew inside? That I was sneaking to the convenience store, the same old habits that I had ever since I can remember, buying the binge food, hiding. How good, does anybody else here got really good at hiding the evidence? Oh man, I knew every trash can in town to hide the trash. I did most of my eating in the car. I would get up and I would skip breakfast because who needs breakfast? I don't need breakfast. I'm even hungry in the morning. But on the way to the work, I had to stop for coffee. And what do you get with coffee? You know what I mean? And hide the evidence. But then, I was gaining weight again. And I was so scared and so desperate. Everything I had rested on me losing weight. And everybody, I got all this, you know, my neediness. The world says I'm good. You're a good person. You've lost all this weight. You're never going to gain it back. And every time my heart broke a little more because I was gaining it back. And I couldn't get on the scale. And I had thrown out all my clothes because I said, I'm never going to gain that weight back. And I was gaining it back. Meanwhile, I had invested a lot of money in a commercial diet program. And you went into counselors 3 times a week and weighed in, and you followed their food, and they gave you 2 of these little wrap bars a day that were covered in sugar and chocolate, okay? And I would eat this little bar. Now, I'm a binge eater, a binge eater. I broke my full button. I went from, gee, I need something to eat, to I've eaten so much I can barely breathe, it's here, even after I lost all that weight. Didn't matter, I could still binge. And they give me this little bar covered with my addictive substances and tell me, eat them 2 a day. You know, I felt so worthless because I was failing on that diet program, and it wasn't even me. It was the ingredients in what they were giving me. And I hated them, I hated the counselors. You know, I went in and I was never honest about what I ate. Another rare moment of honesty, I went to the counselor and said, you know, I ate 2 of those bars at the same setting. Do you think I ate 2? I had eaten up. They give you boxes ahead. They give you like months ahead. I said, I ate two, so it wasn't totally honest. I had eaten like four. And she said, oh my God, you ate two of them? Didn't you feel sick? And I thought, well, I'm never talking to her again. I'm never telling her anything about me again. So what I did is these poor women who are counselors, I'm sure they were housewives. They were making a little extra money. They had had some success on this diet program. So they had them in there telling me, and I went in and I convinced them, I'm following your diet plan and I've stopped losing weight and it's going back up. And I was such a good liar. I had them convinced I was doing everything because, you know, what I did in my car just didn't count or something. And you know what she said to me? She said, well, maybe you weren't meant to weigh 150 pounds. I used to tell that story early in my recovery as this evil woman who told me, how dare she tell me I was the liar. I was telling her I was following that program and I was blaming her. Now, how dare you tell me I wasn't meant to weigh 150 pounds? There's another person to be resentful at, right? To carry with me. I never remembered the good stuff. My personality is to remember every little thing I think somebody did wrong, said wrong, looked at me wrong, and carry it, stew over it, and hold on to it. And that is the beauty of this program. Through my fourth step work, she was a woman who was doing the best she can, and I was lying to her. And now I had her back to a wall. I could just see myself raging. Why isn't this working? I'm paying you this money. I'm coming in. And she's like, well, maybe you just weren't meant, your body wasn't meant to get that low. And that's the beauty of this transformation. I can let all that go and see my craziness, my part in it, where I was demanding something of her that she was not, I made it impossible for her to even give me what I wanted. And then I blamed her. So, this is where I was at. And I changed jobs, and I told that story last night, how they sent me off with a sheet cake in the car as a goodbye. what a gruesome. The recap the story, 45 minutes later, it was like the man pounding on the bar, how did I get here? It was me with icing on the steering wheel and my clothes in the car, thinking, what just happened there? I ate a half a sheet cake. How did this happen? Meanwhile, you know, I was gaining weight. And I started this new job, and everybody talked about this woman, this crazy woman. She was a how person. This crazy woman, she lost 250 pounds and she kept it off, but you don't want to do what she does. She doesn't eat anything good. Right? Well, what did I hear? I heard she lost 250 pounds and she kept it off for 6 years. And I said, flag, my thing wasn't working. I was sad, I was desperate, I was broken. I was looking for something. And thank you, higher power, that she was put in my path. We came to a food fest at work. There was a potluck breakfast, and I had my little diet center allotment. And everybody else was, you know, eating at the table, and there she was. She had a water bottle. Give me a chair. I gotta have a chair. She had a water bottle. She had a smile on her face. She had a lovely demeanor. She sat in the chair, and she kicked her leg, and she smiled. And everybody else was eating, and I said, why aren't you eating? She said, I had my breakfast at home. I'm fine. And flag. I didn't know what I was looking at, but I was looking at a beautiful, serene, peaceful recovery. And something in me felt that. You know, I love that expression. What you're doing speaks so loudly, I can't even hear what you're saying. There was something in her soul that I saw. So I questioned her. I said, well, I hear you do this diet. And she said, yeah, I don't need any sugar. I don't need any flour. And she went on to say her son had just got married that previous week. I said, wait a minute. Your son got married. Now, you got to remember, I have a son who, you know, has had his issues. And I thought, well, you know, if he ever gets married, I'm eating cake. I said, you ate cake, right? And she said, no, I don't need any sugar. I thought, yeah, they're right, you're crazy. Because my son ever gets married, I'm telling you, I'm eating cake. And I went home, it's like, yeah, she's crazy, don't want it. But it stayed with me. And what was I doing? I was secretly getting my my food and refusing to get on a scale. So I said to my husband, I heard about this thing called OA. The eyes roll. My lovely husband, I love him dearly, but he had had enough. He said, you have thousands of dollars invested in this program and you got a whole cabinet full of these bars. And he says, really? And I said, you're right. I'll stick with what I'm doing. My soul, that was another bottom. It wasn't working. I knew it wasn't working. But I didn't know what the answer was, but I saw a glimpse of it in this woman. Within a week, I don't know if this is higher power, and I don't know if it fits in my definition of higher power. All I know is my higher power had me up that morning. I was a good sleeper then. I'm not a good sleeper now. And I was up, and I couldn't sleep at like 4:30 in the morning. So I came down, and I was doing something, and I threw on the news. My diet center, I saw it at 5 a.m. in the morning, had closed and locked its door, and everybody lost all their money. And I said, yes, yes, yes. And you know, now I don't have to face my husband and say, look, I'm wasting all of our money. They took it. And I could try OA. So now, remember, I'm crazy. I'm trying to live without my substance. Okay? I am a crazy person. I have years of resentments, anger, bitterness, self-loathing. I'm trying to live without my fix. And I hit her in the hallway at work. So tell me, what's your diet? Because it's a diet. To me, it's a diet. And she says, well, wait a minute. I said, no, you have to give me your diet. And she says, well, no, I go to OA. And everybody finds their own food plan. I still heard diet. Oh, well, that's crazy. No, what you're doing works. I would like it. And I said, would you take me to a meeting then? And she said, well, no, I live in a different intergroup. I didn't know what an intergroup was. She says, you have to go find your own. Bless her heart. She told me if I wanted it, I had to find a meeting and I had to get myself there. But I pushed her really hard. And finally she said, read this book on sugar addiction. And it's a non-OA book and it's about sugar addiction. And I took it home and I read it and I saw myself. 100% I saw myself as addicted to specific substances. And then I got a little scared and I mourned the fact that I might have to, because this book said you had to give it up. Entire abstinence. I don't think it was those words. They're the words I use now. And that's such a scary thing. And I mourned it. And I tried a couple of meals. And I thought, wow, these meals are more food than I'm getting on my crazy diet. And they made my body feel good. And I mourned my food. And in true dieter style, I looked up a meeting. I started my food plan out of that book. I thought it was a diet. January 2nd, because I was still dieting and I wanted to feast and drink on New Year's. And I got sugar-free, flour-free, and volume-free on January 2nd before even walking into a meeting. And that was higher power too, because I didn't know what how was. I just knew OA. And the first meeting I picked off the meeting list was a how meeting. And I walked into a how meeting and their format said sugar-free, flour-free, volume-free. And it was what I personally needed that day. I saw a room full of people with that same thing the woman at work had. A light in their eyes, a promise of hope that through the 12 steps, I could have that too, one day at a time. And they were very structured. I'm a black and white person. I need a lot of structure. I need a lot of directions. So I got abstinent and I started this fantastic process. They also talked the steps in that meeting, and they said the answer was in the steps. So I heard that, and I started working the steps. It's my character, I threw myself completely in. I'm either all in or I'm all out. And that's why I think I appreciate how, for me, it was something I could throw myself into entirely. I could look at the guidelines and see that I had met them. For me, that was important. I don't think, I work with people now who figure out their ingredients, and there's many different ways to do that, and their binge foods. I needed somebody to tell me at that point, and I'm very grateful that I got it. But that's just my story. Not everybody's addiction leads them to this weight. That doesn't mean they don't suffer the alcoholic torture of food. And I fully understand that. So don't hear about my incredible weight and think that I'm different. Alcoholic torture is alcoholic torture. And for those who are new, I'm just using that phrase from the Big Book. But it's basically the torture we have by those ingredients that kick off a reaction, an abnormal reaction that other people don't have. My husband doesn't have, my best friends. I'll tell you somebody who doesn't have my addiction. My friend's grandma. When she's dieting, she says, you know, when I really need something, I eat a half a Tic Tac, and that really carries me over. When I have a Tic Tac. She's not me. She's not me, and she never will be. Me, it would be a half a sheet cake to tide me over. So I completely derailed myself from where I was going. So I came in the rooms, and I got abstinent. And at first, I so enjoyed the physical relief of every possible trigger being taken out of my food. My body just went, oh. And I thought, wow, this is too easy. Maybe I'm not a food addict. Very dangerous thinking. That pink cloud at first, I was just so happy. I was finally losing the weight I couldn't lose. My physical cravings were gone. And then I hit my goal weight, and I think for a while, now I was working the steps. I was working the steps the best I could at that time, which, thank goodness, we were allowed growth in this program and a better understanding of the steps. When I hit my goal weight, there was so much attention that I got, and face it, I live on that validation of what I think other people think of me, that kept me going for a while. And then when that died off, the work got hard. My mind started telling me, you know, I started getting pissed off, well, why can't I have the cake? And then I thought, I got gypped because I lost 210 pounds and I feel worse in a bathing suit now than I did before because I got all this hanging skin. And I was pissed at God, pissed at the world. And I was doing my step work, and this is important for this afternoon's workshop. Every single fourth step I had got on my resentment list. And by the time I got to 5, 6, and 7, it wasn't resolved. That put a dent in my recovery. That doesn't mean, I mean, I was able to white knuckle it and I was able to work the steps properly and feel a lot of relief and get it, and then I didn't maintain them. I didn't understand. I was giving lip service to go to any length. And I was saying, I'm doing it the same I did to that woman at the diet center. I'd call up long timers. How obnoxious. I'd call up in tears. I'm doing everything. How come it's not working for me? Well, I wasn't doing everything. I wasn't doing what it took every day, the nose to the grindstone on those steps. I'm sorry if that sounds dreary, but boy, is it worth it. Put in the hard work on those steps. That's what changed my story, my life. I have the same husband who I have always loved, but now I love him for who he actually is instead of who I think he is. And I am so grateful he stuck through this with me that I feel like that was totally undeserved. I was graced with that. I have the same two children that I thought my life was over because they weren't doing what I wanted them to do, and you know what? I ended up with two perfect children. Because I got this definition of perfect at another OA event. The roots of that word go back to ripening at the exactly proper rate. The words aren't exact, but you get what I mean? It means ripening at the perfect rate. Perfect. Ripening at the perfect rate. And the reason that I say I have perfect children, they are who they want to be, who they're supposed to be, and who their higher power wants them to be. Not me, I'm not their higher power, not my higher power. They are who they want to be. And life is so much easier that way, when they can be who they want to be. I didn't do this to myself, there was a process. I don't take any credit for this. The only thing I do take the credit for is some hard work. But that 12-step process is a process. And I had to, first of all, I'm so grateful. I crawled, another speaker came our way 2 years ago, and he said OA should have those double barn doors where the top and the bottom open separate, because the top should be permanently docked shut and you should have to crawl into these rooms. Because I crawled in. And I'm grateful for that. I crawled in. I fully understood that me on my own power can't do it. So therefore I'm screwed, right? I can't do it. I didn't have a God that I thought could do it for me. So I had to make a choice. Was I willing to believe just a little bit that there was a power greater than myself, any power that could do this for me? Then that decision to turn my will and my life over confused me for a long time. And now I just keep it real simple. It's the decision to work step 4 through 9. Because if I'm screwed because I can't do it, and you know, the quote I couldn't find last night because I had a brain freeze. Let me look it up. I love this. Oh, come on, Jill. Somehow. Anyway, Mike will be able to help me. To beat into the consciousness of every man that he can recover despite circumstances in your life. If those circumstances had to change, if my kids had to change, my job had to change, my parents, my mom who had died and the way she raised me had to change for me to be okay, I was still screwed. What had to change? I had to change. I had to change the way I looked at it. I had to change the way I deal with it. And I had to stop running the show. And when I came in, I was such a self-loathing mess. I don't run any show. I don't tell anybody what to do. Oh, all I did was burn inside with why isn't it this way? And if only life were that way. And if only my parents had raised me this way. And if only my first husband hadn't done this. And if only my kids would brush their teeth and clean their room and go to college. Gosh darn it, I'd be fine. Running the show, running the show, running the show. So when I made that decision, now I'm working the steps, but I still followed. My childhood religion was very intense. And that concept of God that I had, I heard, choose your own concept of God. But I couldn't do it. Somehow I kept going back to that. It was almost like I was brainwashed, and it's a tough word, but I couldn't lose that concept. It wasn't until I went to a workshop, a lovely woman in my area, who took us, broke it down into finding a God that works in my real world, in my reality, and that broke open my recovery. At the same time, now see, I think this was higher power too. At the same time, I did a line-by-line big book study. So now I'm in a HAL program, which I need. I need structure. I need to be absolutely clear that I'm free of my food ingredients. I need to weigh and measure my meals. I don't say without exception anymore because I can now go out in a group and be okay, but I do most of the time take my scale with me to restaurants. I have no problem with that. And I weigh and measure much of my pre-packed food that it's all weighed and measured. So I have that going for me. I have a really strong home group. I have a network of friends, but I have this dent in this sinkhole in my recovery. And I started a line-by-line big book study, and I got a new definition of higher power. And that's how the transformation began. I worked those steps. I got my best understanding I've ever had of steps 4 through 9. 4 through 9 affected the change. They created a change in me. And they taught me how to do those things every single day in my step 10, 11, and 12. And I'll talk more about that tomorrow. Is that 25 of 11? Oh, shoot, I still have a lot more time. And I actually came to the end of that. So what will I talk about? Do you want me to talk about step 4 and how step 4 worked for me?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so step 1, look, in a nutshell, like there's two kinds of retreats. There's 12-step retreats where you get to the nitty-gritty of the steps, and then this retreat, I'm interweaving the steps, but it's a little different, so it's hard to merge the two. Step one, I'm screwed, I'm powerless. I have a physical reaction, an abnormal reaction. What is an allergy? What is an allergy? Say you're allergic to strawberries. And I say, here, eat this strawberry, but you better not break out in a rash. Okay, that's like asking me to eat sugar and not binge. Outside of my human control. I also have the mental obsession that says, you know, life will be fine if you just eat that. Okay, now I've come to believe that there's a power greater than myself. I'm not quite sure what that power is, but I'm willing to have an open mind and an open heart and redefine what's going to work for me. Step three, turn my life and my will. My life and my will, what is that? My thoughts and my actions is basically the way I look at it. I had to make that decision, that tough, nobody wants to make decision that God is all or God is nothing, has to be the answer, because on my own, I couldn't do it. So what, are we going to share this job? Doesn't work. Half measures avail us nothing. So how do I find out what God's will is for me? Like, that was very confusing in step three. I'm like, well, okay, how do I find out? Trust the process and keep going. Just stay with that realization that you have to stay abstinent to do, well, you don't have to do anything. I have to stay abstinent to work these steps, clearly. And that step three decision is just to move on to step four and not dally. Don't take your time. It's a race. Because you know what? When I first put down the food, it was a race. It was, how long can I manage white knuckling it before I finally find the power that's going to do this for me? And that power just doesn't come on a silver platter. There's a process to get it. And that process was the steps. And step four is critical. And I've done many different styles of step four. But I'm going to go to a simple form. You don't need a form. You only need a big book. But a form helps me as far as talking about it. So the step four is broken down into three categories. Resentment. Resentment, we think, is the number one offender. When I first came in, I don't resent anything except the fact that I can't have my cake and be skinny. And I thought if that were fixed, I'd be fine. Well, it ended up, I resented the hell out of an awful lot of things. So we look at our resentments. What are we resentful at? And I'm trying to think of a good example. I can't think of a good example. A little thing. All right, let's take something really simple. This was actually a step 10 I did in the last couple days. I did a lot of step 10s in the last couple days. I got on the airplane to come here, and I'm hemmed in against the window, and there's a whole group of people that are traveling together, and I think half of them had horrendous head colds and coughs. And they sneezed on me, literally to blow my hair, and I'm coming here, and I'm like, God darn it. I'm going to get sick in the middle of this thing. I really need to do it. Would you people stop sneezing? And boy, I was resentful. You know, a resentment inventory can be a what we think of as a stupid, petty little thing. It could be a really big thing. My mom raised me in this religion that made me a freak. Or it could be, gosh darn it, why are these people on a plane and sneezing? So, let's take the simple one. I'm resentful that all these people on a plane had a cold. The causes. They're going to get me sick. And basically, they shouldn't have got on the plane. What does it affect? My self-esteem? Now, eventually, I find I can check off every single... She's got allergies. She's fine. It's just allergies. This I know. But wait till we get to the end of this step 10. It's beautiful. It affects my security. Am I going to survive this weekend without a terrible head cold and up here and unable to speak and unable to talk? My ambitions. I want the people around me to be healthy so they don't get me sick. Ambitions is what I want life to be like, because that's the way I want it. Not reasonable, just what I want. My personal relations. Well, It affected the way I maybe looked or spoke to some of those people on that plane. My sex relations, not necessarily. Is there any fear involved? Fear was huge. It was huge. Because being a self-centered person at that moment, I was worried about myself, not them. Heaven forbid that they were miserable and they were in this big machine that changes pressure and makes it worse and makes them feel... Where was my empathy at that moment? But anyway, that's further along. Let me turn this sideways so I can read it. Then comes the resentment prayer. God, help this person, and perhaps they are spiritually sick, which actually was physically sick, at that moment to find empathy. How many times have I gotten on a plane sick? I honestly can say that I have. Now, the core character defects. What is at the base of it? I was selfish. I wanted the plane ride to go a certain way. I wanted to be comfortable. I wanted to be free of fear. I was dishonest. Maybe they weren't really blowing my hair forward. Maybe I'm being a little dishonest, a little overdramatic, you know? Self-seeking. Somebody else may be able to help me with that, but it's hard to distinguish that from selfish. Self-seeking is mostly, for me, having somebody else make me feel a certain way. So that doesn't necessarily apply. And frightened, fearful of getting it myself. Now, if I did not have those character defects, if I was not selfish, if I was not dishonest, if I was not frightened and fearful, if I was not relying on self, instead relying on higher power to get me whatever I needed to do this weekend, then you go backwards through your columns. Well, then I wouldn't have been resentful, would I? The problem stemmed from within me. The problem wasn't that they got on the plane with a cold. I also learned like these turnaround questions that say, turn it into I think and I want. I think nobody should get on a plane with a terrible, terrible cold. Really, Jill? I hear myself, that's the way I think, really? That's what got me ready. You know, I gave it away in step 5, which is critical. Don't ever skip the giving it away. When we take an honest look at where our thinking is and where our part is in that resentment, we naturally become ready to surrender them to God, because who wants to live like that? When we honestly look at, there was me on that plane wasting away moments that I could be grateful that you guys were bringing me out here. Grateful that you had the money to pay the airfare. Grateful that the plane was flying safely and got me on the ground. Instead, I was wasting away the moments in resentment and in directing the show, running the show. It's this process that works me through that, and I'm jumping way ahead because it was actually a 10th step. Because I already have the relationship with higher power that I work on every day, I could give it away instantly to somebody. Now, I couldn't on the plane because I couldn't even text somebody, and the person next to me spoke another language, like, trust me. But I could give it to somebody the next time I could. But actually, working it through this process and the point I am in my recovery, I could see where my problems stemmed within myself. The problems did not originate with those other people on the plane. They originated with the way I was looking at it, the way I wanted it to be, the way I was wishing life were different. And I can go to my higher power and say, yes, higher power, I see myself. I'm ready to not live like that anymore. I'm waiting for you to take it away. Show me what you would have me be. Show me what you would have me be. Now, if we applied it to something much bigger, like I am no longer resentful at my mother for raising me in that religion. I was for a long time, and it took a lot of step work. You know, take it back to those sentences. I think mothers should always do this, and I think mothers should always do that. Well, that's me running the show again. And I know that my mother did absolutely the best she could. She loved me intensely, and everything she did was for my benefit. How can I work this through the form? I'd have to be more specific. Okay, well, let me go for it. I'm resentful at, it's hard because I'm no longer resentful at it. So I had to remember what it was. I was resentful at my mother for raising me in that religion. The causes, it made me feel different. It made me feel less than. I basically think it was almost cult-like. It affected everything, my self-esteem, my security, my ambitions on what I wanted my childhood to have been like, my personal relations, look where it took me in my personal relations, my sex relations, and boy, was there a lot of fear involved. So where now, you know, things that happened in our childhood are difficult in a step four, because a lot of times we feel like, well, those are things that were done to us. I had no part in it. My part in it is I was dishonest about what really happened. Yes, some of it kept me separate. Some of it gave me an incredible community within my religion. I was being dishonest in that it gave me a lot of really good core values. I was choosing to ignore the good parts and only looking at the difficult parts. Self-seeking. I wanted my childhood religion to make me feel a certain kind of way. And I wanted it from this religious organization, not from a higher power. Frightened. It made me fearful because I clung on to a lot of those things that at the same time I said I didn't believe in were still there in my thinking. You know, the kind of God I had, the kind of God I believed in. That step four work was probably not the best example. It worked? Okay, good. Because what it did is, you know, like somebody once, it was almost a little scary, took me back into meditation that they had written themselves. And it put me as a little girl on a swing in this meditation. And my mom, and we were supposed to think about what we, and I knew exactly what I was wearing. And we had a swing in the backyard, so it kind of worked. And our mother was supposedly looking at me out the window. And it was truly, I felt that she looked out that window with love. 100%.
Absolutely.
Even if she never said it, I knew it. And that's the power of these steps and this step work. And I'm ahead of myself because I was trying to save some of this for tomorrow, but it doesn't matter. It's all good. There's the story we want to tell. There's the story we do tell. And then there's the story we wish we told. There's three stories at every speaking event. And I have to go with, I prayed so hard before coming here to be useful, to be helpful, and to do God's will every minute of every day. And that's sometimes difficult. It sometimes makes me go outside of my comfort zone. You can do a step 10 on. If I'm fearful of coming up here and speaking, do a step 10. For those who are not up to step 10, I apologize. It's just a mini step 4. But I prayed hard this morning that God would direct my thoughts, part of my step 11, direct my thinking, bring it to a higher level, help me be fit. These steps changed me and they made me think more. I'm not perfect. Trust me, I am nothing above human. I am you. We are all the same. We have our common weakness, but we're tied together by our common solution. We are a 12-step organization. And these 12 steps are available for anybody to work. That apartness that I felt all my life was removed. I can walk, now it's really easy with you guys, your fellows. I can walk into any group of people and not feel like the outsider. I can't even describe that difference. Okay, the food, I have no desire to eat food. Okay, that's basic. That's the number one. I walked into a family funeral and I had brought a large salad, so I made a large salad for 200 people because I had to have enough for me too. And I walked over and I got my salad and I walked back and I'm sitting with my husband and he says, wow, that was some dessert table, huh? I said, there's a dessert table? He said, you walked past a 7-foot-long table of desserts and you didn't see it. That is a miracle, okay? That is a miracle. The fact that I can pull my clothes out a season later is a miracle. What people don't realize is through working the steps, there are so many more miracles than that. To walk into a crowd of people and feel, it's described perfectly, and I have it written down in some of these stories in the big book, to feel that I am a part of something really big, a tiny, humble, little speck of part, but I am part of something big. To live with a sense of belonging, of purpose, of connection, that I now have this inner power. Okay, I'm powerless, but I found an inner resource that goes with me at all times, and the only time I can't access it is when I block it with my resentments, my ambitions, my fear, my judgmentalness, my wanting to run the show. And trust me, it's an ongoing process. It will never be done. It will never be done, but I promise you it gets so much better and so much more rewarding that you can't help but want to do more of it. And you know, I was going to offer during one of the sharing groups, if anybody wanted a workshop, a step 10 or a step 4, but I don't want to bump out any of the sharing groups. I mean, there's lots of room for everything if anybody wanted to do it, but we could do a real actual where you sit down and do it. Okay, she asked if I could talk about how I worked steps 6 and 7. The first few times I thought they were stupid steps, like really, who put those in there? And then I have to admit, one time I was like, well, no, I'm not ready to surrender these because who knows who and what I'm going to be. I can't deal with that, but I'll just move on. Mistake. All I can say about 6 and 7 is in step 4, this thorough inventory, and there's very specific directions about step 5, and making sure you were thorough enough that those step 5 promises actually, and if not, keep going back, not for a year, but for a brief amount of time, intensely look back at anything you've missed, right? Now I see where I'm faulty in my own thinking, I see where my defects are doing it to me, and I'm like, all right, I get it, God, I'm ready to surrender these. 6 and 7 are very fast. Be humbly ready to say, is my life going to work if I keep hanging on to these defects, or am I willing to surrender them? And am I willing to let God remove them? I can't fix them. If I could have changed my own defects, I wouldn't be here. I would have fixed them myself. I needed something greater than myself to do it. 6 and 7 is actually pretty simple. I should probably, if I want to speak more about it, I should get the page open. I have two big books. I have one that is so written up I can barely read it anymore. Oh, my microphone waiting for my mouth. And I have this other one that's called Working with Others that has just the very key things highlighted, the very, very base, and sometimes it's easier for me to look at. We look at step 6. I think we have like 5 minutes. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. We are now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are we ready to have God remove all the things that we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. The willingness is enough. Are we willing to surrender it? It doesn't mean we can immediately accomplish it. Look, I take my will back every day, every time I fall into fear, worry, anxiety. I have to practice 6 and 7 every day as part of my step 10. Because after I do my step 10 and I do that quick inventory, which I do several a day, I have to go through 6 and 7 and say, all right, God, I'm going to let you have this because I can't fix it. It's not a self-help program. It's a process. But we surrender it to God. When we're ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. It's a part of my daily practice and my daily prayers. It doesn't say remove every single defect of character so that I can be happy, so I can live in utopia, so I can have a perfect life. It's remove every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. And we have completed step 7. Six and seven shouldn't take a long time, as long as we've done the footwork up through step five. But it doesn't mean they aren't critical. They're critical for me every day. If I start thinking, okay, I saw where I'm doing, you know, in my step four, I only did the resentments. I didn't do the fear or the harms. Okay, why I say line by line. A thorough reading. I read the big book, and I read the big book, and I read the big book, and it was written in this language I really didn't understand. It was written by, and I would read a whole chapter, and I would remember two things out of it, and I really didn't get it. I had used a workbook that broke it down and made me look at every line, reflect on it. Most of them were turned into questions, and I had to reflect on it, read it. And then I had a lot of people who know what they're talking about explain some of the history and some of the background and some of the meaning of some of those words. And I don't know what it was about breaking it down that just made it sink in, made me understand it. I don't know. A lot of things happened at once. That different definition of a higher power, you know. It doesn't have to be line by line. There are ways to take somebody through it that you just read it together, and I've worked with others where I, you know, the first assignment is read the doctor's opinion, find the important parts, and we discuss the important parts. I had the privilege of a line by line. I had 4 years of abstinence. I had lots of time. I was still a little crazy, but a newcomer, I don't know if a newcomer would survive a line by line, gutting out the abstinence to get through it. So I do find a lot of people with a long time in program who say, yeah, I've been abstinent 10, 15 years, but I don't have what you have. Will you work with me? That's when we do a line by line. Okay, fear inventory. We got a few minutes left. That's perfect. I probably use the fear inventory more than I use anything else. I am a person with a lot of fear. Some of them are reasonable fears, and some of them are unreasonable fears. Doesn't matter. Anything that takes up space in our head is worth doing an inventory on. Yes, there are many different sheets and many different forms, and you can probably talk to anybody in the room and find a million different kind of forms. You don't have to have a form because the instructions are right in the big book, but a form works for a lot of us, and there are a lot of different kind of forms. I try and stick to the cleanest and simplest forms.
Let's just give Dylan a hand. Woo!